From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you buy a book, do you check out the photo of the author on the book jacket? There's a lot of time and money invested in the belief that you do. Think of the pressures on the author to look good. On today's Fresh Air, we hear about the makeovers and misadventures of author John Searles as he posed for his first book jacket photo. Then we'll hear from Marion Ettlinger, a photographer famous for her portraits of authors, including Truman Capote, Raymond Carver, Joyce Carol Oates, Russell Banks, and Sarah Vowell. Also, classical music critic and poet Lloyd Schwartz reads a poem by Elizabeth Bishop that he saved from obscurity. It's about to be published in The New Yorker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The president has chosen investment banker Stephen Friedman to be his new top economic advisor. The selection of Friedman comes despite objections from some Republicans. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The appointment of Friedman came despite an intense lobbying effort from conservative members of the party who felt he might not be sufficiently supportive of proposed tax cutting. They pointed to his past involvement with the Concord Group, a deficit reduction organization, but in accepting the appointment to be the president's top economic advisor, Friedman seemed to indicate he's on board with the administration.
I strongly share your conviction, sir, that now is the time for a robust growth and jobs policy.
The president praised Friedman as an innovative thinker. Friedman replaces Lawrence Lindsay, who, along with Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, submitted his resignation last week. It's expected the White House will soon propose a new stimulus package that will include tax cuts for businesses and individuals. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
A federal court in San Francisco has reinstated the Clinton administration's ban on commercial road building in U.S. forests. The ban prevents road construction on nearly 60 million acres of federal forest land, and it bars the extraction of oil or the cutting of timber except for the purpose of fighting wildfires. Last May, a federal judge in Idaho issued an injunction against the policy at the request of the Boise Cascade Timber Company. Oil and mining companies also opposed the Clinton policy. Environmental groups praised today's decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. An attorney for Boston's Cardinal Bernard Law says the Archbishop will comply with a subpoena to testify before a grand jury investigating possible criminal charges in the clergy sexual abuse scandal. NPR's Tovia Smith reports from Boston.
Attorney General Tom Riley says Massachusetts law gives him few options to bring criminal charges against Cardinal Law for abuse committed by others, but with tremendous public pressure to hold Law accountable, Riley says he's pressing on just to make sure. And he's lashing out at the church for impeding his investigation and for, quote, not doing the right thing.
By doing the right thing, I mean they clean house and they cooperate. And they try to work with us to get to the bottom of this and to find out the truth. Obviously, that has not happened here.
An attorney for Cardinal Law insists the Archbishop has been and will continue to be cooperative. He says Law will not invoke his Fifth Amendment right, but will show up to testify. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
People in New York City are making plans to get to work without public transportation in case there's a transit workers' strike next week. The union contract expires on Sunday. Transit officials will go to court tomorrow to request an injunction against the possible strike. In stocks today, the Dow lost 51 points to close at 85.37. This is NPR News. NASA officials are sending an Idaho school teacher into space next year. The announcement comes 16 years after the Challenger tragedy. NPR's Eric Kneeler has more.
51-year-old Barbara Morgan was a backup to NASA's first teacher in space, Krista McAuliffe. The two trained together before the Challenger disaster in January 1986. Morgan had returned to her second-grade classroom in McCall, Idaho, until NASA revived the program. She spent the past 4 years training for another chance. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe said that Morgan will be assigned to a shuttle mission in November 2003. She'll be helping five other crew members assemble part of the International Space Station and talking to schoolchildren around the world through live video links. At a press conference Thursday, Morgan told a group of Baltimore high school students that she was proud to continue the mission begun by McAuliffe. Eric Kneeler, NPR News, Washington.
The Bush administration has approved a slight increase in fuel economy standards for sport utility vehicles and light trucks. Beginning with the 2005 models, automakers will have 3 years to improve gas mileage on the vehicles by about 1.5 miles per gallon. That's up from the current fleet average of 20.7 miles per gallon. Auto industry groups said the increase is significant and will be a challenge to automakers. Environmentalists said the increase was far below what automakers already have the technology to achieve. An effort in the Senate to require far bigger increases in fuel efficiency was defeated earlier this year. It would have required overall vehicle gas mileage to rise up to 35 miles per gallon by 2015. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 3 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Subaru, maker of a full line of all-wheel drive vehicles like the Outback, Forester, and WRX. Subaru, the beauty of all-wheel drive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can't judge a book by its cover, but let's face it, many of us do look at the author photo on the dust jacket when we're browsing in a bookstore deciding whether to buy the book. So imagine the pressure on the author to look great in the photo. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Marion Ettlinger, a photographer famous in the book world, for her author photos. First, we hear some of the misadventures of an author getting photographed for the jacket of his first book. John Searles is the author of the novel Boy Still Missing, which came out in hardcover last year and was published in paperback this year. It's a coming-of-age story set in 1971. Although this is Searles' first book, he's an insider in the book world. He's book editor at Cosmopolitan magazine. If you want to see the photos we're about to talk about, check out our website, freshair.com. Okay, when you started the process of getting a photo for your book jacket, how much did you care about the picture?
I mean, I wanted it to look nice, but I didn't care half as much as HarperCollins did, to tell you the truth.
Now, why do they care so much?
They had all this criteria. They wanted me to look inviting and photogenic and attractive and sexy, and I just wanted to actually smile and not have my acne scar show up in the photo.
Now, why do you think it's important to be attractive and sexy, you know, from your publishing company's point of view, if you're a writer?
Well, they think in today's media-focused, media-obsessed society, it helps get you on TV and in magazines and newspapers because they'll run your photo, so they want you to look as good as possible.
What were your issues when you started to make the rounds of photographers?
Well, my first photographer was my mother, actually. I asked her to take a photo of me. So, you know, my whole life, we've taken our photos in the front yard by the stone wall with this fir tree. That's where I stood for my communion, my prom, my graduation. That was the spot where you stood for special occasions. So, you know, I went and got some film for the Kodak, and my mom and I stood up front. I stood by the stone wall, and she snapped away, and we developed it, and I found one I thought that looked good, and I sent it off to my publisher, and I got a call a week later from my publicist who said, about your author's photo. No. So she didn't like it.
Did she tell you why?
Yeah, she said I needed something that made me look more authoritative and, you know, more attractive and something just a little bit more authorial.
So what was the next approach?
So then I enlisted the help of my friend Stacy, who I waited tables with for 12 years. And when I wanted to be a writer, she wanted to be a photographer. So I thought, how fitting that, you know, she'll take my author's photo. So we set about taking my photo, and we drove around to find different backdrops. I remember she took me by the sea, and she took me by this barn and by a tree, and we were just all over the place all day. And we had 12 rolls of film, and we picked a few shots, and I sent them off to my publisher, and then they called me and said, no, that they're too long-faced. And then I remember my publicist's assistant said, think of Sebastian Younger's photo. You need to look like him. And I said, I look nothing like Sebastian Younger. I mean, I have, you know, he's sort of this dark, brooding, macho man, and I have, you know, brown hair and blue eyes and light skin, and we just don't look at all alike. But she said, it's not really Sebastian Younger so much as the essence of Sebastian Younger. And I remember saying, that sounds like a cologne for sailors.
So what was the next approach?
So then they sent me, well, then I realized, you know, I'm also the books editor at Cosmopolitan magazine, and I thought, wait a minute, I work at a magazine. I have, you know, all these photographers I can enlist to help me. So I asked the photo editor to hook me up with a photographer. So they sent me to a Cosmo photo shoot, which was in downtown Manhattan at Chelsea Piers. And I remember the night before, I got a phone call from the stylist, Clyde, who said, oh, he's just this crazy, kooky, funny guy who said, okay, what kind of ensembles do you have? And I said, ensembles? And he said, well, look in your closet and tell me what you have, because otherwise I can call in some Dolce & Gabbana for you. And I said, it's just an author's photo. I don't think you need to call in any Dolce & Gabbana clothes for me. So I looked in my closet and I told him, you know, well, I have some flannel shirts, some denim shirts. And he said, well, do you have a suit? And at the time, I just had one suit. It was a black suit from Country Road. And I told him that, and he seemed disappointed. He said, well, throw it in a bag, and I'll send a messenger over, and I'll have it steamed for you first thing in the morning.
So how did the Cosmo shoot go?
Well, so the next day I show up at the studio, and they, you know, it was another photo shoot in progress for Cosmopolitan. So they sit me down next to this, you know, beautiful, skinny model who's eating strawberries and smoking cigarettes. And as they, you know, start cutting my hair, she starts regaling me of tales about her South American bodybuilder motorcycle riding boyfriend and their breakup and their relationship. And so then the hairdresser comes over and says, how do you like your hair? And I said, you know, I like my bangs to kind of come down over my forehead. And she said, okay, and then promptly cut off my bangs that come down over my forehead. And I was upset, but she said, trust me, baby, it'll look fabulous.
Did it look fabulous?
I didn't think so, but they did. It was sort of one of those Caesar cuts, and I just wasn't used to it. But I think these photographers and stylists were so used to dealing with models and these, you know, beautiful freaks of nature that they didn't know what to do with an ordinary person like myself. And so next up was the makeup, and then the makeup artist found out I was the books editor at Cosmopolitan as well as a novelist, and she started telling me about a beauty book that she had an idea for that an editor stole and made millions of dollars on. So as she was telling me this story, she was getting more and more angry and was taking it out of my face, putting more and more layers of foundation and powder on me until I was a brilliant bright shade of orange and looked like I had just stepped out of a 9-hour session in a tanning bed. So then Clyde said, you know, it's your baby, you're on, and called me over to this stool, which is in front of this all-white backdrop. And I remember, you know, I'm not used to having my photo taken, so I feel self-conscious. I'm not a model or anything. So I remember the photographer's assistant, the makeup artist's assistant, the stylist and the stylist's assistant, and the board models all came and stood around as I was getting my photo taken. And Clyde unbuttoned my shirt just about down to the middle of my stomach, almost to my belly button, yanked the collars of my shirt out so I looked like a 747 about to take flight. And I said, you know, I don't really feel comfortable. And he said, shush you, it's very 70s Playboy, just roll with it. So then he spread my legs from east to west and said, look into the camera and show him what you've got. So I felt very uncomfortable, and finally I said, you know, I just don't think this is working for me. And I remember the photographer, in a last-ditch effort to try to get me to feel comfortable, said, just think John Updike. Think John Updike. And I said, you know, John Updike's a great writer, but I don't really think he has the look we're going for here.
No, he certainly doesn't.
So then I pulled my collar in and buttoned up my shirt, and then I remember one of the models said, well, think about that guy. Who's that guy who wrote the book about the storm? And someone said, oh, that guy is so hot. I love him. And so once again, I felt, you know, second to Sebastian Junger when it came to photography.
No, it sounds like this is one of those shoots where you show up and they have like a wardrobe for you. And they dress you, they change your hair, they change your look. And then you wonder, like, if a reader wants to see you and see what you look like, they're not going to see who you are at all. They're going to see who somebody has made you into being temporarily for this photograph.
Exactly. I felt like it looked nothing like me. And in the photo, you know, my sleeves are rolled up, my shirt's buttoned down, my collar is flared. We didn't end up using this photo, but I just remember it looked nothing like me. And thankfully, my publisher agreed, so we didn't use it. And then I was sent to my last and final session with another photographer who finally got the photo they wanted, which actually I don't even love so much. I think I look like Katie Lang in it, but they like it. So,
let me ask you to describe the actual photo that's on your book.
Okay. I'm wearing a suit, a black suit with a black sweater, so it's very dark. And The photographer thought I looked vaguely like Michael J. Fox, and so she kept trying to say, show me more Michael, and so I didn't really know how to do that. And I have one wisp of hair that comes down that I always have a cowlick, and so that they left this hair because they like the effect, but I think that adds to the KD effect. But they thought I looked sincere and attractive and inviting was what they said.
Are you happy with it?
I'm happy enough, but you know what, Terry, by the time I was done, I was just so happy that finally they liked something and I could just, you know, stop this foolishness and go back to writing.
If I saw this photo and then ran into you on the street, would I recognize you from the photo?
I think you would, yeah. I mean, it doesn't, unlike the one that I took at the Cosmopolitan shoot, this one does look like me. I'm a little bit brooding when in real life I think I'm a little bit, you know, lighter and happier than this photo, but it does look like me.
What are some of the different kinds of places you've seen your author photo reproduced?
Well, I think it was reproduced in People magazine when they did a review on me, and Time magazine named me a person to watch, and I think they did the author's photo there. So that was kind of fun seeing it in, you know, in big magazines like that. And also sort of jarring at the same time to open a magazine and there's little me. And bookstore windows, when I did a signing at Barnes & Noble, you know, friends would call me all excited and say, you know, my photo was in the window of the store. And so I would go down with my boyfriend and he'd force me to stand in front of the window as he snapped dozens of pictures of me standing in front of a picture of myself. And that I was so self-conscious about, Terry, because I'm standing on a crowded New York City street, I think on 6th Avenue, and so many people are walking by. And there I am standing in front of a picture of myself. I felt ridiculous, but he said I would thank him later.
Now, you're not only an author, but you're the senior books editor at Cosmo.
Yes.
So you have to help decide what books are going to be reviewed.
Exactly.
Do you often look at the dust jacket photo to evaluate whether this book is worthy of your attention?
You know, I do look at them, I must admit, right away. And I've been sent so many funny ones over the years. I remember there was this one. I get sent everything, even if it's not appropriate for Cosmo. I was sent this one gay novel, and I remember that the author was posed on top of a cannon. So the cannon was coming out from between his legs. And I remember saying to the person I work with, is he trying to get a date or sell his book? I'm not quite sure.
So in what ways are you influenced by the author photo on the dust jacket?
Well, you know, if somebody looks like they're trying too hard, to be honest, it just kind of bugs me when they're overposed or they just look like they're just trying too hard. I like a simple photo where someone looks sincere and interesting. But, you know, for example, Danielle Steele, her books are sent to me. And it's just funny, in each of her books, if she tries to have a photo done that matches the topic of the book. So if the book is set in a Western sort of cowboy setting, she's wearing a cowboy hat and standing by a horse. You know, so she does, each photo matches the topic of the book. And, you know, I get sent these fitness books, and the fitness books, there's always a woman in a leotard doing a Wonder Woman sort of pose or a guy flexing his biceps. And so it's just funny to note the things that people will do. And I was recently sent a novel about fishing, and the author was standing in the middle of a stream with waders and holding a fishing pole. And it's just, you can't help but look.
Yeah. So what are you going to do for your next book? I don't mean the book. I just mean the photo.
Okay. Clearly, I don't have a say in the matter, so I wish I could tell you. They'll probably decide. But I would like to maybe just use the same photo so I don't have to go through this again. But, you know, I'm up for it. I laughed at it, and it just became another funny story. I told people about the whole crazy experience of being published, and honestly, I dreamed of being a writer ever since I was a kid. And so the fact that people wanted to take my picture for a book, how can I complain about that? You know, it's better than waiting tables, which I did for 12 years. So,
No, I don't mean to seem very shallow because, you know, we're talking about your photograph and not the book. But this program is specifically about authors' photos.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I think you should have a chance to tell our listeners what your book is about.
The book is set in the early 70s, and the main character is a 15-year-old boy who becomes infatuated with his father's mistress. And they get into a sexually charged relationship that leads to this grisly accidental death that he feels responsible for. So it's part coming-of-age story, part thriller, actually, too, because it's lots of twists and turns and surprises. And I wanted it to be the kind of compelling novel that kept you turning pages, and I hope I did that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a real honor to be on your show, Terry.
John Searles is the author of Boys Still Missing and is book editor at Cosmopolitan Magazine. You can see his photographs on our website, freshair.com. Coming up, Marion Ettlinger, a photographer famous for her portraits of authors. This is Fresh Air. Now that we've heard the frustrations of an author getting photographed for his first book, let's hear from Marion Ettlinger, a photographer who's famous in the literary world for her author photos. Truman Capote, Joyce Carol Oates, Raymond Carver, Ann Patchett, Edmund White, Robert Stone, Cormac McCarthy, Richard Russo, Russell Banks, Sarah Vowell, Andre Debuse III, and Bell Hooks are among the many writers she's photographed. And she swears she's never told any of them that they should try to look like Sebastian Younger. She's known for her brooding, introspective portraits. Ettlinger will have a book of her author photos published next fall. In the meantime, you can see a few of her pictures on our website at freshair.com. Ettlinger started photographing authors in 1983 when she was hired by Esquire magazine to do portraits of 45 authors and journalists who had contributed to the magazine's 50th anniversary issue. I asked her why she likes to photograph writers.
I remember when I was a kid, I had a card game called the Author's Card Game, and it displayed on each card a different portrait of a writer like Tennyson and Longfellow and Thackeray and Oliver Wendell Holmes, and they just looked so biblical and fabulous to me right off the card. And I guess that sensation that I had when I saw these images stayed with me, and later, as I became someone who liked to read as well, it just all kind of gelled. And I have done portraits of many sorts of wonderful and creative people, but when I started to photograph writers, I did feel this great sort of satisfaction and click about that these were my natural subjects.
Do you think of your author photos as having a certain look?
I suppose that that's true. I am told that that is true. And I think that, you know, early on when I saw a bunch of my photographs displayed somewhere side by side, I took a step back, and I did think they had a cohesive look to them. And that actually is when it dawned on me that, well, maybe I could get these published or something. It was the fact that they did have something that glued them together in a look.
And what was that?
Well, the most important aspect that I strive for in a portrait is that the person is present in the portrait, that they are there. And it's extremely interesting when I review my contact sheets at various times, and there are 30 images in a row that are virtually identical in terms of the pose and the setup and everything. And the variations really might come from the most subtle expressions in the face of the person. And in one frame, they're there. They're utterly present. And the next frame, they're kind of not. They've drifted. And that's not to say that drifting can also be something that is lovely and that you want to use, but that sense of presence is really key to me. And also, especially with authors, I like to bring out the fact and to make them look smart and soulful and maybe sexy. And often the first two might just you know, make the third one a certainty.
Why sexy? Why does a writer need to look sexy?
They don't need to look sexy, but I guess if you're in the camp that you find smart and soulful sexy, then they just will.
Now, a lot of your photos of writers, the writers look very kind of, the men look kind of hard-boiled. There's a certain drama about the women. What if a writer shows up and they're really just kind of schlumpy, you know? And to really capture the essence of this person would be a photograph of a schlumpy-looking person. What are you going to do? Are you going to go for the schlumpy, or are you going to, like, rework it so that you've got that drama or the hard-boiled? You know what I mean?
Well, maybe I can't go from schlumpy to hard-boiled, but I think even the schlumpiest of us have our better moments, and that's what I'm looking for.
And how do you find it?
You know, you just look for it. You just be with that person. You try to create an atmosphere of permission, I'd say. And if you wait around long enough, you might see something go by you that is a kind of a transformative, but yet still true to the person aspect. And you either try to, you know, get it as it's happening or recreate it. Like, you know, some people in their pre-photo nervous state might say, oh, you know, I'm really not photogenic, trust me, and want me to know that. And I understand that because, you know, I think there is such a thing as that photogenic, and I think a few people have that. But I think most people don't have that. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that being photogenic is not required, because I think everybody can be photographed well or not so well. And if you're photogenic, well, that's just like gravy. But, you know, and anybody can be photographed the best version of themselves. Even a schlumpy person has a range.
Photographer Marion Ettlinger will talk more about her pictures of writers in the second half of our show. A book of her author photos will be published next fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From WorldCom, a summary of progress in finances, service, and business practices, and a look forward, available at worldcom.com/update. And Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, shooting Truman Capote and Sarah Vowell. We continue our conversation with photographer Marion Ettlinger. She specializes in portraits of writers. And classical music critic and poet Lloyd Schwartz reads a poem by Elizabeth Bishop that he saved from obscurity. It will be published next week in The New Yorker.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Marion Ettlinger, a photographer famous in the book world for her portraits of authors. Authors like Raymond Carver, Cormac McCarthy, Richard Russo, Ann Patchett, bell hooks, and Sarah Vowell. She has a book of her author photos that will be published next fall. In the meantime, you can see some of her pictures on our website, freshair.com. Let's look at some of the photos that you've taken. You have a photo of Truman Capote in which he's in profile and looking up. It's a very odd angle, and his mouth is kind of turned down into a frown. Talk about that pose.
It was a shoot for a magazine, and he consented to do the shoot, and he with the request that the office of the magazine, which was Esquire, by the way, would inform him 3 days before the shoot and remind him that this was happening, 2 days before the shoot, remind him the day before and on the day. And so they did that. I was on the road, and they kept up with me and telling me that he was with the program. And except for the day of the shoot where they couldn't get hold of him, but they said, go ahead, go anyway. And I went there and knocked on the door, and there was nobody home. And I went away for a while, and when I came back, I was driving up the driveway, and a car was coming out of the driveway, and we stopped and rolled down the windows, and a friend of his, I believe it was Jack Dunphy, said hello, and I said, hi, I'm here to photograph Mr. Capote, and he said, good luck, and he rolled up the window and drove away. So I went, that doesn't bode well, and I drove up to the house, and this was early on in my work life, as I might have mentioned, and I was getting out of the car, Truman came running and screaming out of the house, waving his fists in the air, like it was very cartoon style, and screaming about this was the wrong day and he can't be bothered with this and Esquire, you know, why'd they send him such an amateur and pretty much terrorizing me. And then he said to me, you know, I've been photographed by all the greatest photographers in the world. And I said, oh, yes, Mr. Capote, I've seen those photos, and they're just wonderful. And he continued in that mode until he said, well, okay, let's get it over with since you're here. And so I said, okay, well, let's go into your house, and I'll look around. And he said, well, I'm not going to let you in my house. What do you think, I'm crazy? Why would I let you in my house? I said, well, okay, perhaps you would like to change shirts or what you're wearing, because he was wearing kind of a grubby sweatshirt, I believe, that said something on it, like, I don't know, Sagaponic or something. And he said, I'm not going to change, and this is what I'm wearing. And, you know, I said, okay. I said, well, perhaps we can go over there on the veranda. I see there's some nice old chairs up there. And he went, I'm not going up there. It's really dirty up there, and I'm going to get all dirty. What do you think? And it was at that point that I realized that he was just going to deny me everything. And I had tears of rage creeping up my throat. And I was thinking, he's going to ruin this for me. He's going to make me fail. I'm going to look really bad, and it's going to be his fault. But it won't matter because I will just have failed. And then as I was quivering, he said, start now or get out of here, basically. So I went, okay. And we, standing there, I just started to photograph him. And the first frames are him just glaring at me. So maybe to relieve myself from that gaze, I asked him to turn in profile. And he turned in profile. And as he did that, he started to do this extraordinary thing where he just started to lift his head and raise his chin, and he started to look truly magnificent. And I suppose I murmured some words of encouragement, and he continued to do that and held that, and I took the rest of them that way. And when he heard the last shot being made, he said, that's it, goodbye, and walked back into the house. And the great art lesson that he taught me was that, well, prior to him, Well, basically, I know what kind of photo I would have taken of him if I had had my way. And it would have been fine, but hopefully. But prior to him, I had only known courtesy, cooperation, and all kinds of nice stuff. And I just assumed that those things were crucial in order to get a good result. And he taught me that that's not necessarily true, and that if you go with what's happening, something much more interesting and more beautiful might happen as a result of that. So I've always, I mean, I kind of respected and loved him before I met him, and him, even with my little trauma in the middle, I just kind of loved him more for it all in the end.
Now, I should mention, too, that this photo is in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty close-up, pretty tight close-up of his face, though you see some of his you see his neck and some of his shoulder, and he's wearing that T-shirt, though you can't see what's written on it because the shot doesn't go down that far. But it's a very high-focus shot. I mean, you know, you see every wrinkle on his face. You see the pores on his skin. Why did you go for that type of real, you know, high focus?
I don't think I consciously said I'm going to do that, but that's how it came out. And I was happy with that result because it's such a close-up of his head and his, it's a side view, so there's a lot of cheek and neck and space in it, and the fact that it's populated by a bristle of beard and a line, I think just gives it this wonderful sense of who he is. And I personally don't find it to be an exploitation of his age or condition at all. I think he looks very much like a Roman senator, or some people have said he kind of looked like Marlon Brando in that photo.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah Val, you took her author photo.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very tight close-up of her face. She's kind of like surrounded by darkness, but her face is illuminated. And it's a very kind of sober, almost grave expression on her face. And whereas her writing is very funny, and her writing is so much about being like neurotic and nerdy, and her look is so different in this photo than her sound, or I think than her image in person.
I had never seen her before she entered. Oh, actually, I think I had asked her to send me a photo before I met her. So I was really struck by, I'm sure this is part of radio world, that people's expectations of what you look like and what the person actually looks like are either right on or totally no relationship. And I had a very specific image of her in my mind, which was not what she looked like at all, just even in terms of being fair or dark and all that. I have always detected a dark side to Sarah's work,
mm-hmm.
Despite her incredible wit and her offbeat take on things. And in person, I found her a very serious person.
So that's why you wanted to go for that more serious look.
Well, I think in general, my work has a somber quality to it. In the case of somebody who's written, you know, a hilarious novel, then I try to get that twinkle or levity in the eye, but it didn't quite happen with that photo of her.
Now, you specialize in author photos.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many writers who are, well, they're kind of loners. You know, they work all day alone at home. And some writers aren't the most social people. Many of them are kind of eccentric. And a lot of them are self-conscious and not that comfortable being photographed.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you're being photographed, you know, a lot is at stake because it's going to be on your book. This photo is going to live longer than you are. So I'm sure a lot of writers are very uncomfortable about getting their picture taken. Are there things that you'll say to a writer early on to try to reassure them or put them at ease?
Well, often we speak before we meet, and I try to communicate just that we're going to try to do something good, then I'm on their side, basically. But what you were saying before about writers being solitary people, it is so true that so often when they come to me, either they're at that moment where they've or at some finishing point of their book, and they are truly coming out of a cave and kind of blinking in the light, and boom, for all of a sudden they have to do this exterior work that is really not about what they do at all. And I definitely want it to be a gentle transition, or not as bad as they think it's going to be. And actually, one of my most favorite things to hear that I hear frequently is that when we're taking leave of each other, a writer might say to me, "Well, that wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be." So, and that fills my heart with joy. I'm always happy to hear that.
My guest is photographer Marion Ettlinger. She specializes in portraits of writers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Marion Ettlinger, a photographer famous in the literary world for her portraits of authors. Now, when you photograph a writer, do you work with a stylist? Does someone who you're working with show up with stylish clothes for them to wear in case their clothes don't look good enough for the shoot?
No. I work alone. I don't have an assistant. I don't even use lights, by the way. So some writers request some of these things, mm-hmm. and then I'm happy to oblige. But it's certainly not something that I need to happen. I don't have any costumes or anything lying around. I might have a few staples, like a black T-shirt or a black skirt that's kind of all-purpose, just in case we want to get some... You know, like somebody only has a pair of, plaid pants or something.
Yeah, right.
You might want to quiet down that part for certain photos, and then I might have something that, for those emergencies. But I don't have outfits at all. And the writer's own clothes are the clothes that I want to use.
Now, nearly everybody is pretty self-conscious about their face. And, everybody has parts of their face that they think are their real weak parts, whether it's a blemish, a receding hairline, a big nose, wrinkles, whatever, big ears. So if somebody's self-conscious about their part of their face, do they mention it to you usually? Can you make my nose look small, that kind of thing?
Yes, I've been asked to perform all sorts of miraculous acts. most are beyond my powers. But I like to be aware of it, because certainly in photography you can do things that bring out good and or bad things, and I'd rather bring out the good things. I mean, I feel like one of the mandates, I'm not sure it's the right word, of my work is to isolate and perhaps exaggerate the uniqueness of the subject, not necessarily their uniquely bad feature, but the uniqueness of what is the best in them, what is the thing that is striking and makes them look uniquely like themselves. And I like to try to turn things in that direction.
And going for that isn't necessarily going to mean making them look more handsome or more pretty, right?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, it might mean having their face have a lot of character, but not necessarily having it be pretty, right?
Right. It can mean bringing out this incredible sculpture event that's happening on their face, the cut of a bone. That's wow. When you turn the head this way, there it is. you know, and it's totally amazing. And that adds a sense of, I believe it adds, rather than beauty or handsomeness, like it might bring some drama and some sculptural event to the photo.
Now, I think one of the most difficult things for somebody who's getting photographed by a professional photographer for a publicity shot, for a book, or whatever other reason, is that it's almost like a fashion shoot in the sense that you're almost like a professional model. You have to be there posing sometimes for hours,
right?
Off and on for hours. And if you're not a professional model, it's really quite a strain to be under the gaze of a camera for that extended amount of time, and to have any sense of focus or affect.
Are you speaking from personal experience?
Well, I am, actually. I've had to take, not for a book, but I've had to take, you know, publicity shots. And
right.
I just find it exhausting and trying, and I'm not good at smiling on demand. So if a photographer says, okay, smile, I mean, well, sure, I can make those lips move, you know, in the imitation of a smile, but it's really not going to be very convincing.
Well, I don't permit smiling, so let's get that
straight. You don't even permit it. to tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't. Although, you know, when I look at my contact sheets, eventually something will have happened during the shoot that makes a person laugh or smile, and it's a thing of beauty, of course. But for what I'm going for, see, I feel like that is a lovely thing, and perhaps has more of a place in the history of the person and a person, more of a personal photo. But I think for something like kind of going for a more of a, I suppose, iconic moment or image, I feel like a grin, kind of in the best sense of the word, distorts the face and distracts a little bit from this structure that I'm so interested in. And now that's not to say that I'm trying to save the photos from grimness most of the time. I mm-hmm. do like them to be serious. But that doesn't mean that I don't welcome, like, levity and wit and all those good things to come through the face. But I think they can come through just fine, short of a big grin. I think they can come through the musculature of the face and it's corny to say, but through the eyes. And just in the expression. And that will happen hopefully during the course of the shoot when somebody feels slightly amused or something. And if it's not there, I might add for a drop of it if I need it for a certain thing. But I never say smile.
You shoot in black and white. Why not color?
Because I find, first of all, I do respond to color in many people's work, but I can pretty much say that I don't respond to color in portraiture. And I find black and white a riveting medium. It's my medium. That's why I work in it. To me, color is another, it's another medium. It's not, it has nothing to do with what I do. And I don't want to see it. I like the way black and white breaks things down, and I love the whole chiaroscuro of it. And, you know, it's a question I've been trying to think of the answer to for a really long time. Like, why? What is it about black and white? And I mean, man, you know, like, love black and white movies, old ones, new ones. I just... And what is it? Why? What is it about it? And I'm embarrassed that I've never been able to really put my finger on it and articulate what it is. And I'm sure somebody can or is, and hopefully I will be able to, at the end of my life, know what that thing was. But it's just what I see and respond to. It turns me on.
You're going to have your own book coming out in 2003, a book of your author photographs. I assume you're going to have a photograph of yourself on the cover of the book. Who's going to take your picture?
I took it.
You took it already?
Yeah. Actually, I took it a few years ago before I knew I was going to have a book, just because I realized I was pretty photographically absent from the earth and spend my life recording others. And I thought, all right, I better get this done. And so I, with dread, with the same dread that my subjects approach me, I made a date in my appointment book for about 3 weeks hence. And on that day, I got all dolled up, and I went to my studio, and I met myself and put myself in that other position. And, you know, I have very simple, old-fashioned equipment, and so I don't have, like, any kind of sophisticated way of taking my photo without, like, jumping up and down between every frame and hitting a self-timer. So it was, like, turned out to be kind of an athletic and strenuous activity. Actually, the next day, I felt like I had been horseback riding or skiing or something. Like, every bone, new bones in my body hurt that I hadn't realized were there. And it was an incredible experience because at first it was, like, utterly confusing. Like, who am I? Who am I looking at? It took me, I was baffled and confused. And of course I couldn't see myself, which is what I'm used to doing, is seeing my subject. So I was shooting myself blind. And then I feel like at a certain moment, the accumulative visual history and information of watching my own subjects before my camera suddenly kicked in and informed me about who I was and who was I looking at, and all those questions suddenly fell away, and I was able to be present in that odd situation. And what I can say about the results of that day is that I got a number of photos that I can certainly live with, but the thing that really made me happy was that the photograph of myself looks just like the photos I take of other people. It there's not a jarring, and then she photographed herself. Like, it just seemed, in my view, I guess others can tell me whether they agree, but it looks like one of my photos. So got that over with.
Photographer Marion Ettlinger, a book of her portraits of writers, will be published next fall. You can see some of her photos on our website at freshair.com. Coming up, classical music critic and poet Lloyd Schwartz reads the Elizabeth Bishop poem which he rescued from obscurity. It will be published next week in The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz is also a poet and has written extensively about the American poet Elizabeth Bishop, who died in 1979. Lloyd tells us the story of how he got to know her and how he happened to have the only known copy of one of her poems. That poem will be published for the first time next week in The New Yorker.
I first got to know Elizabeth Bishop when she moved to Cambridge in the early 1970s after living in Brazil for nearly 20 years. I admired her small output of poems, and I was thrilled to meet her. But she was very shy about discussing her work, and I didn't think I had anything else to talk to her about. Eventually, the barriers began to come down. I was floored by the new poem she was writing, and it got to be easier to tell her that. We got to be friends under circumstances unfortunate for her, but lucky for me. She'd had an accident during Christmas vacation. Her friends were away, but she remembered my complaining that I'd be stuck in town. For a week, I spent every day with her at the hospital, stopping off at her apartment to pick up her mail and any other odds and ends she requested. Suddenly, we found it easier to talk about movies and records. She loved Mozart and Billie Holiday, and some more personal things. I even got to see a new poem she was working on called Breakfast Song. It was a short love poem, but more than that, it was a poem about facing her own mortality, or her reluctance to face her mortality. I thought it was amazing, and courageously open about her feelings of love and fear of death. I wanted to read it over and over. And when she was out of the room for some medical procedure, I copied the poem without telling her. I think maybe I was also worried that it was a poem she might decide was too personal to publish, that she might even destroy it. She never published it during her lifetime. After she died, I hoped that someone would find it among her papers. But although numerous unfinished or unpublished poems have come to light since her death, Breakfast Song was not one of them. A couple of years ago, when I heard that her publishers, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, were planning to publish a volume of her uncollected poems, I thought it was time to confess my guilty secret. I still feel slightly queasy about what I had done, but I couldn't bear not being able to read this poem. Breakfast Song. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. I kiss your funny face, your coffee-flavored mouth. Last night I slept with you. Today I love you so. How can I bear to go as soon I must, I know, to bed with ugly death in that cold, filthy place, to sleep there without you, without the easy breath and night-long, limb-long warmth I've grown accustomed to. Nobody wants to die. Tell me it is a lie. But no, I know it's true. It's just the common case. There's nothing one can do. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue, early and instant blue.
Lord Schwartz is editor of Elizabeth Bishop and Her Art and classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. His reading of Breakfast Song was recorded for Fresh Air in 1998. The poem will be published for the first time in the Christmas issue of The New Yorker. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002 books, titles, and characters in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, former President Jimmy Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to excerpts of our interviews with him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.